Welcome back to the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I are with Edward J. Larson. We are all with invited guests at the Commerce Club. Dr. Larson, the synthesis.
Well, what we're talking about before the break is what's now known as the neo-Darwinian synthesis or the modern synthesis, and that's putting together these ideas of Mendelian genetics as further worked out mostly by a great Southern scientist, probably the greatest Southern scientist, Thomas Hunt Morgan from Kentucky, who more than anybody else then picked up these ideas, the Mendelian genetics, and worked them out with fruit flies with a whole team of scientists. Those ideas, sort of Mendelian genetics as worked out by Thomas Hunt Morgan, were taken along with the evolutionary ideas of Wallace and Darwin that had been come out of that strain, and they were synthesized together. Now, again, it's a theory. People will argue, evolutionists will argue, that common descent is an observed fact. But the theory of how it works is the theory of Darwinism, the theory of evolution. And it's a now not old Darwinism, it's modern neo-Darwinian synthesis. And that is that changes happen at the genetic level. That small, Thomas Hunt Morgan would have called them mutations, but so we'll use his term. That's probably too strong for it. But small changes will happen at the genetic level, such as when species get recombined, when there's recombination, when the egg and the sperm mix together, things mix together slightly a different way. Chromosome gets mixed, the gene gets mixed differently. Radiation can cause mutations in genes. Hybridization across different sort of species when they mingle can cause a new mutation. So the genes are different, a little bit different, just a little bit different. But as long as they can still survive in the population, then they can reproduce. And they won't be swamped by crossbreeding. That change will always be there. And then this is the way that Darwinian synthesis is now, the neo-Darwinian synthesis. If the environment then changes so that a different trait is more beneficial, such as if the species goes out to the limits of its extreme and tries to push on, or if the climate changes, or if something like this happens, or if a new competitor comes in and so a different thing is beneficial to survival, that different trait in the species can then blossom and quickly cause the species change. That is, the variety is already buried in the genetic structure. But it might be recessive, or it might be it might even be dominant, but not fully expressing itself. Then, when those conditions change, that strain can exploit that new environment, and either in a whole new environment or in an existing environment that has changed, that new species then takes over, and then the next change and the next change, and that's the modern neo-Darwinian synthesis that has gained general acceptance within science since, say, about 1950.
There's a parallel piece of this that in some ways you cover wonderfully in your Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Summer for the Gods. But it comes up in this, I for years...
Which is about the Scopes trial,
right,
in the 1920s.
I've had a hard time understanding how the Germans could go crazy. The Germans who
in the 1930s and 40s?
In 20s and 10s and
yeah.
90s and on. This highly civilized, extraordinarily well-educated people could degenerate into what happened,
Nazism.
Was ultimately manifested in the death camps in Nazi Europe. But that process that is also paralleled in this country, and there's some there's some crossovers and flows of the eugenics the attempt to make humans better with the best of intentions, and then somehow it goes terribly awry.
Well, as we said before, there's an evolutionary tie there. One of the things that struck me most in the research fits this sort of an anecdote. I was Ernst Haeckel, who was very much influenced by Darwin and was an evolutionist, even though he's a bit of a Lamarckian evolutionist, he was still brought in the strain by reading Darwin. In Germany, late 1800s, he becomes the most public advocate of evolution theory in the world. His books were all published in America, bestsellers, like The History of Evolution, The History of Life. He had a whole series of books, very popular, very influential scientist, did cutting-edge work. He was he had profoundly racist views. And he tied it to an evolutionary tree. And I found in one of his books, because all of his books were published in America, he had one, History of Evolution. And he has in there a tree of all the different humans. And it goes back to the earliest Pithecanthropus, the name he invented. And he has them all branch out. And you can, he puts the current names, I mean the tree, and he puts the current names. And it takes two, you have to fold it out in his book. And this was widely read in America. It's in all the libraries, in, you know, University of Georgia Library, where I got my copy. But it was all over, widely quoted, widely used. And he viewed the Aryan race, there's the Aryan strain, and then there's the non-Aryan strains. And the High Germans are at the top, the Dutch are real close, the English are pretty darn close up there. And then you get over, and you can see, you know, the Jews are way over on another page. The Hungarians are in a certain place. Africans are in a certain place. And you can then, and that became very influential to the Nazis. Mein Kampf quotes it, cites it. He turns his scientific views into a political movement that was the Monist League that led to pushed Germany into the First World War because they thought they were the dominant race and they were going to take over. He was very frustrated when they lost at the First World War, and it morphs into Nazism after Haeckel died.
It was state Darwinism.
And you can see how, you can go back and see how the Nazis treated each country when they took over based on where they are in Haeckel's trees, how the French get treated versus the Dutch, who are treated very well when they're conquered, versus the Poles, who are treated very poorly, versus the Lithuanians, who are a little better. It almost maps exactly where they fit on Haeckel's tree of life. It's spooky stuff.
Well, and there's the tie-in, the connection in this is goes back to the Scopes trial. William Jennings Bryan and this religious piece that starts out one place and ends up almost totally reversed. How did that happen?
Well, Bryan himself, William Jennings Bryan, it was a liberal, democratic American politician. He was concerned. He'd looked at these Haeckel charts, and he was concerned about, some of these implications of the sort of the dark side of social Darwinism that Darwin himself never dabbled in this depth of materials, even though he knew Haeckel, and Haeckel used to visit him all the time. He pointed this all out in this when Bryan was arguing against that we should limit evolutionary teaching. He would point to people like Haeckel. He pointed to this in the textbooks used in Tennessee, this sort of racial hierarchy, the scientific racism, as it was called. And he said, this is one of the grave dangers of this, and this is one of the reasons it should be limited. Now, his ideas were picked up by religious advocates who may have been more concerned about the religious implications and the social implications. But with Bryan, you get a man who was sincerely interested in both. And why it got so far in America, why he was given a hearing, why he could get his ideas, being William Jennings Bryan, get quoted in the New York Times and get his articles in the New York Times and Tribune, is he was including these social critiques along with the religious critiques. And that made a lot more people listen.
And his wife warned him.
His wife warned him not to get tied up with the religious end of it. His wife was concerned about the social end, but his wife warned him that this is going to be misused.
It interests me particularly because it says again how important ideas are. That ideas are not something that you pull off the shelf when 9 to 5, but that they have immense implications with who we are and who we choose to be, come to be, and that has not ended. These conversations about evolution are very important in the present day and will have profound effects as we move forward, won't they?
They will, and it's important to realize, though, when we talk about Haeckel and the Monist League and the Nazi abuses and beyond abuses of those scientific ideas, that you could do this, you could pull tremendously good and humane things coming out of Darwinism as well and of evolutionary thought. Very progressive, humane, liberating ideas come out of it, as well as these ideas get used in different ways. A lot of times people bring their own pre-existing ideas, their own biases, their own views to a doctrine, whether it's a religious doctrine or a scientific doctrine, and then it's ripe for use and abuse. Of course, whether it's use or abuse depends on your own view. Some people think that what we would call abuse is a good use. But it leads in a lot of different directions. And I try with the book not to be as fair as I can as a historian to point out the various different implications, roots, and sort of results, following the tree down to its roots and out to its fringes, to continue the Darwinian metaphor.
It's surprising how many fights there are that you don't take sides. But the fights are from the very beginning, and they continue to this very day, do they not? Let's talk a little bit more about the present as it applies to evolution. Edward J. Larson has written the book, Evolution, and a number of other books as well. We'll all be back with him in just a moment. Please be with us when we return.